Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hi, everybody. I have just finished another amazing book for the podcast, and today I'm talking with author Amy Sherman. This most recent book by Amy, Agents of Flourishing, Pursuing Shalom in Every Corner of Society, is so rich, Amy. This is just, when it says every corner of society, I feel like that's no joke. This is not a marketing ploy. This really does touch so many areas. And I would challenge listeners and readers of this book that there is some area inside of this book that Amy talks about that we probably already feel passionately about, and something where we might just need a little nudge, a tool, an idea, something that we can go to the Lord with and say, hey, maybe I can start practicing this, whatever it is, for the flourishing of my neighbor and my community. So thanks for coming on to talk about it, Amy.
Thank you very much for having me and for your interest in the book.
Oh yeah. It's really good and it's really rich. And I also want to tell people that you give the disclaimer right away that I totally took advantage of, which is you don't have to read it all in one sitting. You don't have to sit down with this all at once. It's pretty dense. But it's divided up into sections that will help you kind of, with a focus area, I think, for different people with different interests and different ministries in mind. Right. So Amy, I would like for you to kind of just maybe to start us off by giving us maybe a kind of twofold question. I'll give you a twofold question here. One is, this book was birthed out of your work. So I'd like for you to tell us about your work. What do you do? And then also, just what did you envision for readers of this book when you were writing it?
Yeah, great. Well, you know, when people ask me to describe what I do, I often will say, I feel like the Lord has called me to be a minister to ministries. So what I love doing is coming alongside of congregational leaders and, Christian nonprofits that are trying to do good in their communities. And they need help thinking through that. Maybe they want an evaluation. Maybe there's some great ministry that I found out about and I just want to shine the spotlight on them. And so I write a story about them. Or maybe they've asked me to come and they're thinking about how to replicate somewhere else, or they're, you know, needing a new strategic plan. But I love getting to come alongside of Christian leaders and helping them to even be more effective in their outreach ministry. And so this book grew out in large part of a question that I feel like I was hearing, or a comment that I feel like I was hearing a good bit, that was actually a pretty encouraging, in a way, question or comment. And that was that pastors were saying to me, Amy, we're really trying to cast vision in our community, in our church community, for being a people for the city, for being a church that's living into that verse in Jeremiah 29:7, where it talks about seeking the peace and prosperity of the city. We're taking that seriously and we want to do it, but honestly, I don't know exactly how to do that. And Not exactly sure what that should look like. We want to do it, but need some help. And so that was really the impetus for the book, wanting to do something that would help those folks out. So the vision for the book, I think, is to both equip those congregational leaders who are already committed to this idea of wanting to lead churches that make a difference in their communities, that are seen as contributors to their communities, that are taking seriously this call in the scriptures to love their neighbors and to be a blessing to their neighbors. But I hope also that it will inspire some others who maybe aren't as familiar with this way of thinking or aren't as familiar with just how extensive the Bible's attention is to these questions of seeking our neighbor's flourishing, and just how rich our Christian history is. For me, one of the most fun parts of working on the book was studying church history and seeing all the amazing stories from the past of how the people of God have been involved in seeking the thriving of their communities and in all different dimensions. That was a really fun part of the work.
Yeah, that was something that that I really appreciated about the book, because I tend to not necessarily be a history buff. And so my concentration a lot of times can just go to right now, you know, we can do this. We can, you've seen churches with, daycare centers, or, you know, there was one just read this morning about, you know, a thrift store or something like that. And these modern ideas, but going back to, Christians were building hospitals, right? We were going into places with plagues, not coming out of places with plagues, and that it really is a rich history, a rich Christian history of not just caring for our neighbor and their needs in this benevolent kind of way, which is good, and we've always done that, but also seeking the flourishing. And I really like that language that you use throughout the book. We're not trying to help people just to get by necessarily. What we're wanting is for them to live this abundant life that Jesus talks about, right? In their physical lives right now.
Right.
Yeah. So you have, before we get into a few of the specific topics that I hope we can hit on today, you have this book organized by section, and you call them community endowments. And I really love that language so much, because for me, it gave me a context. So a little bit of background on me. I'm in an MDiv program right now at Fuller, which is phenomenal, because I feel like this seminary does a good job of integration when it comes to justice work and faith. But I also have a master's degree in social justice from a secular university that I got a decade plus ago. And so my mind always goes there. We say, well, yeah, of course we want education equality, right? And I think that that's a good thing. I think everyone can probably agree that that's a good thing. That's not something that's controversial, but to frame it in this way, right? To frame it as part of, I think you frame it as part of the true, right? To put it in this context just made that call so much richer to me. So you have the good, the beautiful, the true, the just and well-ordered, the sustainable, and the prosperous. And each of those realms goes along with something very tangible and practical and needs and areas of flourishing that we can see right now. So what was kind of your, why organize it that way? I know you spent kind of a significant time in the introduction saying why, but why organize it in that way with those community realms?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, it's a book that tries to take really seriously the idea that God really cares about flourishing, that God created a world of shalom, and that he is going to restore full shalom in the new heavens and the new earth. And then the in-between parts, Jesus is on the move. And we're called to join him in his work of renewal. So God's passionate about flourishing. We ought to be passionate about flourishing. We are called to seek the flourishing of our neighbors. Okay, well, then let's define what is this thing called flourishing, because the secular world has its own definitions about it. But the Bible has very, very rich understanding of what flourishing really is. This framework, it's called the Human Ecology Framework, and it was developed by a group called the Thriving Cities Group, I thought was such a strong framework, because essentially what they were doing is they developed this paradigm, was they were saying, okay, well, what makes for a thriving city? And their answer was, well, you have a thriving city when these six different dimensions of societal life are each robust and healthy and strong and sort of strongly interconnected. And they came up with, these names of the good, the true, the beautiful, the just, the sustainable, and the prosperous. And rather than calling them arenas or dimensions or realms, they decided to call them community endowments, because an endowment is a dynamic rather than static thing. An endowment can go up, you know, like if a university has an endowment, they hope it keeps going up and more people are giving money and their amount of, funds to spend go up. But sometimes endowments go down, right, in hard times. So they wanted to capture the idea that these different realms are dynamic, and they can be stronger or weaker depending on the intentionality of the citizens in trying to bring health and strength to these arenas. And so if I was trying to write a book that helped pastors figure out, well, how do we seek the flourishing of our city? I was like, okay, well, here's a way of thinking about that. If you want to have a thriving community, it's got to be strong in each of these different arenas. And by breaking it down into these different arenas, I think it begins to give people some handholds. And it begins to, I think, help them recognize, oh, given what God has blessed this congregation with in terms of our physical assets and our people assets, it might be particularly strategic for us to try to contribute, you know, to this particular community endowment. So I have gone to a church for many years that has a lot of medical people, a lot of healthcare people. It makes sense for my church and my community to think about, you know, what would be some ways that we can contribute to strengthening that realm of the city. So I organized the book, you know, using that framework. And the other reason that I really landed on that particular one was because as I was really studying, well, what does the Bible teach about flourishing? Because there's all sorts of secular philosophies, and we have sort of modern, very Western, very highly individualistic, you know, depictions of flourishing. But what is a scriptural view of flourishing? And as I tried to identify what I call the marks of true flourishing and began sort of inventorying those and beginning to write them down and cluster them, you know, into similar things, it was like, oh, goodness, look at the amazing amount of resonance and alignment. Here, the Thriving Cities Group, these faith-friendly scholars, they've identified these six arenas and the institutions within those arenas. As you mentioned, the educational system in the arena of the true, or, the criminal justice system in the arena of the just, for example. Well, gosh, when you look at how scripture says these are the things that really matter for human flourishing, I just saw this amazing amount of overlap and resonance and alignment between the framework and that biblical idea of flourishing. So I realized that, wow, this could really be a helpful framework for folks trying to answer that question of how to seek the thriving of their city.
Yeah. And it was, thank you for explaining that. It was just so good because I think sometimes for me personally, my bent can be toward, this just seems like common sense, or, I learned this there in this other setting, but to bring it back to be able to kind of biblically base it, in these arenas just felt really good to me. It felt really strong.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think it's really important because, of course, at least more conservative evangelicalism has, I think, sometimes, focused only on a couple of these endowments rather than on a broader view of them, right? So the arenas of the true and the good have historically, I think, been very important to the kind of conservative Christianity. And that's good and that's right, but it's not the whole story. And so there's a comprehensiveness about the biblical understanding of flourishing, and there's a comprehensiveness about this framework that I think is, it's just theologically accurate.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let's start with one of those. So for our purposes, I've kind of thrown out, if we get there, and I'm going to say we may not, but if we get there, some of the sections that were really just stood out to me when I was reading were on the true and on the beautiful and on the just. And I would say that beautiful section for me, I grew up in conservative evangelicalism, and that was one that just missed me. I'm not saying it's the fault of my tradition, but I will say that one just missed me. And it's only been maybe in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years that I have been kind of reintroduced to that idea of the beautiful and that God is really in that. And so I can't wait. I'll try and make sure we get there. But the true, I mentioned I'm in school, I've got 4 kids, right? And so even just to the point that we were uniform shopping this week, right? This is very practically on my mind kind of all of the time. But instead of, like I said, I've kind of framed it in some ways and with kind of a more secular or maybe just a really an individualistic or even just kind of secular community ideas that I think are good and they yield decent results. But I want to start with a couple of these that you point out to, which is that God has actually designed us all as people to be learners, and how even just bringing that theological idea into this community endowment makes a difference in how we practice this.
Yeah. I mean, again, when you really try to study human flourishing as depicted in the scriptures, obviously you have to take human nature seriously. You have to really try to understand, well, what is the Bible really teaching us about human nature? And the fact of the matter is we're people that have brains, and yet we're people that have brains that develop slowly over time. We don't show up on the planet already knowing everything there is to know. God designed it so that we are built to slowly acquire new information, new understandings, to make new discoveries. God inherently put into us inquisitiveness, God gave each of us, intellectual capacities that have different, different types and different strengths. And there's this reality to the idea that discovery is just sort of an important part of human flourishing. There's something really fun, something really satisfying, something that just sort of makes us feel alive in this whole notion of learning and of discovering. I have a friend of mine who's got four boys, and they're older now, but when they were little, I've never forgotten it. It's probably from 20 years ago, but she was laughing about the fact that, like, she sent her little kid off to kindergarten or whatever, and one day he came home and he's just bursting. This new fact has come to him, and he's just bursting, and he can't wait to tell his mom about it. And he comes up and he says, "Mom, you know how it looks like the sun goes up and kind of moves around the earth? Mom, it's not that. The earth goes around the sun." And she's like, "Yes, I know. Isn't that amazing?" And then he looks at her and he's like, "You knew that? And you didn't tell me?" So it's such a delightful picture of the joy of discovery. And yeah, God designed us to be learners. And God is infinite and ineffable. And we are going to spend all of eternity learning and discovering more about God, right? So this is a really important part of our flourishing.
Gosh, I just love the way you describe that, Amy. It just almost brings me to tears. And I think it's because I haven't been a formal student in so long, And so now it's like, I'm devouring books, I'm devouring lectures, and I feel like that kindergartner, right? Like, I just cannot get enough.
What really knocked my socks off in thinking about this was, it was like a further dimension of wonder over the incarnation when I sort of realized, well, wait a minute, oh my gosh, like Jesus was a learner. Like Jesus in his human form shows up as a baby and he doesn't yet know everything. I mean, he does know everything in his divine form, and he's fully human and fully divine. And you can't even wrap your mind around that. I mean, that's just way too complicated. But yet there's this reality that there was an unfolding of education and learning, even by the second person of the Trinity. So honoring human nature, including the part of human nature that is this part of us that is made to grow in knowledge. And that even was Jesus's own experience.
Yeah, I almost brought that verse up just a couple of minutes ago, thinking that, and Jesus grew in wisdom and favor and stature, he didn't know how to walk, right? Like, like Mary and Joseph are calling him, right, to come across and take those steps. And just thinking about Jesus teaching us how to be human, that includes this design, this divine design for us to be learners. But let's take that a little bit further when we talk about these community endowments. Because we all know the stories that are the exception and not the rule of, well, so-and-so didn't go to college and look at him, or so-and-so didn't have this or that advantage, but, she made it this way or that way. But, and those are beautiful and amazing stories, but there, I think, is something in us. I think the way you phrase it is that supporting quality education for all is a justice matter. So we're all designed by God to be learners, and supporting that inside of these systems is something that as believers, I'll just like say it, I guess, like we should be doing that, right? We should be supporting that, not just getting tickled that somebody learns a new fact or sees a pretty butterfly they haven't seen before, and that becomes a part of their, but actually, what does that look like on the ground every day for kids and adults who are inside of systems that are learning systems or educational systems?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, God wants every kindergartner, I think, to have a wonderful educational experience, whether that kindergartner is a child of a believer or the child of a non-believer. You know, God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. So God cares about that. And then we have to honor, part of what it means to honor the dignity of each person and the imago Dei, the image of God in each person, in each child, is to say, wow, we need to be a society that is gently cultivating the mind of each little tiny image bearer, whether they're in the rural areas or the urban areas, whether they're in a poor community or a wealthy community. It's just part of what loving our neighbors and our children means. And it's very practical too, because education is so tightly associated with so many other, you know, future opportunities for folks. It's got to matter to us. It's got to matter to believers whether the children on the other side of town are having equal opportunities, are having the chance to grow as the little intellectual beings that God made them to be, and to come to the fullest fruition of what God wants to see them blossom into.
Do you have in your mind right now an example from the book, or just an example from elsewhere in your work, where you saw a church or a community of believers really fostering this in a way that was really powerful, had a big impact, or just stood out to you as being particularly creative, maybe?
Well, in the book, I talk about the ways that different churches are partnering with some different national ministries that take really seriously children's education and the desire to really support particularly lower income kids or kids in public schools that are just struggling, you know, a little bit more. And one of the stories I talk about is this, you know, tiny little church in a more rural community. I think it's in Tennessee. I can't quite remember off the top of my mind, but I just remember there's a national ministry called Kids Hope USA, and they essentially recruit churches to get matched up to one particular elementary school in their locality. And the idea is that the church will recruit mentors who will go in weekly to the school and really bond with one of these struggling kids and develop a relationship with that child and encourage them and, you know, read with them, do homework with them. And then there's even some other special activities that they suggest that the churches put on for those kids that are matched up. And I called the director of Kids Hope USA and I said, you know, I think highly of your program and I'd love to hear some examples of some churches that you feel are, you know, just really, really sold out, you know, really, 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 really committed. And so she put me in touch with some of her, you know, like state level people. And one of them came back and said, you've got to talk about, you know, this church. I think it was like Cumberland. I forget exactly the name of the church. But anyway, the church has like, you know, 50 people or less. And for over a decade, they have provided like more than half of the people in the church are signed up. And they're just all about like, this is the thing that they do for outreach. And they are so engaged in this local elementary school and they love these kids and they do things in the summer with these kids and they invite these kids to come to, you know, to the church and they love on the kids in the school. And they're so completely sold out and committed, to these kids. In this particular school and they stick with, you know, the kid year after year. It's the most beautiful thing. And I loved that story because so often the really sort of inspirational stories about church outreach that you hear come from relatively larger churches or relatively more affluent churches. They just have a lot of resources and so they can kind of go out and do these really cool things. But you know, here was just this very modest, you know, very small church. But wow, what amazing testimony and story they have in loving these children.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I just, you know, and it's something I think too. It's the book is full of stories like that are so encouraging because they're not all these big wealthy, you know, or affluent or churches that have a huge population or something. It's like something like that. It's like, I can do that. You know, yeah. I can do that. You know, that's something many of us would have availability to do. But I think sometimes we maybe get a little discouraged because we think it's a small thing or, you know, something like that. But wow, it's just so the power of relationship, again, just the way that God has designed us is so huge and is so much bigger, I think, than a lot of times we kind of, you know, give it credit for. Let's move on to the beautiful. Oh, because this just, I will admit at first, I am not an artist. I am not anything of the sort. My kids make fun of even my stick figures are creepy, apparently. It's all of the things. And because of that, I sometimes personally, I have just struggled because I'm like, I just don't get it, right? Like, I don't get it. This isn't the realm in which I work. I don't understand an artist's mind. Sometimes I don't understand what comes out. You know, my husband, who comes from a really creative family, and his mother was an artist, and he will tell me, you know, when the kids get into these modes, he's like, sometimes you just have to create for the sake of creating. You know, not everything needs to be perfect or kept or this or that. I'm like, yeah, I don't get it. I'm getting better at it, but I just don't get it. And so this section of the book was so encouraging to me because it's an area that I feel like God is growing me in and has been growing me for the past few years. But I think it is, I don't know, maybe it's just my perspective, but I feel like this area, this community endowment, gets really neglected because it doesn't feel like, you know, in the hierarchy of needs, right? It feels like, you know, food, shelter, education, but then art just gets kind of lost up here, right? It feels like something that's not, you know, it's not really needed or whatever, but this is just, I think you make a really good case that this is just not, you know, when God sees us as flourishing, and we see him as beautiful and each other and the earth. Anyway, you're going to say it much better than me. So talk a little bit about the beautiful, this realm.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I'm like you. I can't even draw a stick figure. I mean, I am so non-artistic. And I've kind of been a tomboy my whole life, too. So even like the little girly stuff that little girls do to make beautiful things, you know, they're just focused on flowers or dresses or pretty this or pretty that. And, you know, I'm running around in my Washington Redskins, you know, football uniform at the age of 8, you know, I'm not like making flower arrangements. So the beauty thing is new to me as well. But I think that one of the things that occurred in my life that really made an impact on me. So I've spent a lot of time in poor communities in the majority world and poor communities here in the United States. And it never ceases to amaze me. I think I could close my eyes and picture this one scene in particular in a slum in a developing country. And just how people who had so little materially, nevertheless, were looking to decorate with a flower, or they I can remember this one shack, but they had the people had like cut some colorful pictures out of a magazine, or somehow got a hold of, you know, these colorful magazine pages, and had just sort of, I don't know what they did to like stick them onto the side of the cardboard of the shack. And what it said to me is people need beauty, that actually that whole idea that, oh, well, what we really need is, you know, water and food. And of course we do need those things, but there's something really quite basic as well about a human hunger for beauty. And this has actually been fairly well documented by, you know, sociologists, anthropologists, people that think about this kind of stuff. That there's just really something to this idea that art isn't this kind of optional add-on that, you know, once all these other really important things get taken care of, you know, then you can worry about music or beauty or, you know, whatever. And so I think that really started to change my own view. The other thing about me, in addition to being not an artist, a tomboy, I'm also kind of a cheapskate. And so I've always been one of those people in the church that's kind of like, we're going to vote on the church budget or whatever. Well, let's not spend like a whole lot of money, like making this room all fancy or whatever. Like that's money that could go to, like, you know, we could send that abroad, and there's people starving everywhere. And, you know, so this whole notion of like spending money on making something beautiful, like here's this beautiful stained glass window. You know, I was always the person that was like, we don't need to do that, you know? My views on these things have really changed over the years as I've reflected on how central beauty is to God's own character, how much the Lord delights in beauty. There's so much beauty in this world that He created. The people that make beauty are so obviously inspired by the Maker, capital T, capital M, and by the power of beauty. I think that's the other thing, is that as I've grown older, I have, even me being my frugal, tomboyish, you know, personality, I have increasingly realized, wow, there is nourishment in beauty. There is power in beauty. When I enjoy that sunrise over the ocean, it sparks a wonder in me that is a really important thing. Wonder is such an important quality for a Christ follower to have. There's a peace that comes over you. There's beauty does something to our souls and to our hearts. It's a balm. It's a healer. There's power. There's power in beauty, and we neglect that to our disadvantage, because there's just too much in the scriptures that make it clear that God loves beauty. You know, one of the things I really studied for that chapter was how intricate all of the directions are that God gives to the craftsmen building the tabernacle in the wilderness, and later the temple, and even the instructions about the priestly garments. Like, here I am, you know, 20 years ago, sitting in a church meeting, and all I care about is function. You know, don't spend that extra money. We don't need that stained glass window. Stick a regular old window. It's just all it is about function. And here's all this huge biblical evidence that God cares about more than function. Yeah, you know, the temple, the tabernacle, the priestly garments had all of this beauty. It wasn't just about function. So clearly beauty matters to God. And therefore it has to matter to us.
Mm. I love that. Wonder does something to our souls. It does. I mean, I think it's, you know, I could use the word, if I'm chastising myself, and say, I think I have been arrogant in some of these areas. Like, I know what you need, right? We need to get jobs. We need to get education. We need to get food and water and, you know, a functional, right, place to live or be. And God does want all of those things, I think. And, I think this is not a second tier need,
right,
for us as humans, which is hard for me too. It's hard for me to kind of get that, but once I started, you know, even starting to practice things like that in my own life, I would notice, like, just things when I would notice something, I would smile more, right? Like, more joy, yeah, would come to me, because of the beauty that I had intentionally, put around me. I just think it's awesome. I hope God continues to grow me in that area because it's amazing. I know we don't have much time left, and so I'll say, get the book and read on these other things. But maybe since we were gonna talk about justice, Could you talk about this? This one is kind of a big one, but maybe we'll kind of round out with that, and then I'll let you end this wherever you want after that. But one of the things that you brought out in the book that was huge for me, as I just kind of theologically am working through these things in my mind, is you kind of talk about the relationship of justice and injustice and power. And gosh, I feel like each one of those words is so loaded, especially right now, where we are in the world, where we are in the United States. But can you just say whatever you want to about that relationship of those three things and what that looks like in this setting, this community and endowment and realm of the just?
I've been really helped by my friend Gary Haugen, who's the founder and currently the president of International Justice Mission, which is a pretty well-known human rights, Christian human rights organization. And, you know, he just talks about injustice from a biblical perspective is fundamentally about the abuse of power. That injustice happens when power is not used the way that it ought to be used. The Bible is so clear on the idea that God is both all powerful and God is just, and God delights in justice, and God does justice, and God works justice. These are all phrases that are in the scriptures. And what we see there is that fundamentally, the way that we know that God is just is that God always uses his power in the service of love and goodness. God always uses his power to do that which is right, or to set things that are not right to becoming right again. So with God, God is just because of the way he deploys his power. And we engage in injustice because we are deploying our power not for the good of our neighbor, not in ways that are in accord and in alignment with treating other people with dignity and respect as the image bearers that they are, but instead using power to oppress other people, using power to extract from other people, using power to advance our own interests at the cost of another's interests or needs. And that's been helpful because honestly, these concepts of justice and injustice, they're humongous. And, you know, I was a political science major in undergrad and, you know, read lots of philosophy, right? You got all these people writing, Plato writes about it, Aristotle writes about it, and John Rawls writes about it, and Nicholas Wolterstorff writes about it. You know, these tomes that, you know, these huge 500 page books on, you know, what is justice? And there's a lot of really good things in those books and people should read them. But I have been helped by sort of getting to the nub of it. This notion, injustice is about the abuse of power. And therefore, we have to learn as believers how to steward our power and to use our power well for the advancing of love and peace and just relationships.
That is so helpful. And I needed to hear you say that again. I needed to hear you say that again, because it's so huge. And when we get down to it, that is a helpful way of looking at it. I thought I read it this morning and I can't place it immediately, but one of the things I think that you say in this, in your next steps, kind of in the conclusion of the book, is that God shows us, I'm very much so paraphrasing because I can't find it, but something to the effect of God shows us how to use power and what to do with power. And that is share it. That's how he utilizes.
Yeah. It's such an amazing thing. You know, Jesus, what is Jesus's modus operandi with power? He shares it. He breathes power into the disciples. In Pentecost, the power of the Spirit comes down upon us. We are empowered by the all-powerful God. And therefore, those of us who follow Jesus, we should not only seek to deploy our power in ways that advance justice for others, but we should also share that power. It's not just us going out and like fighting for the little guy, right? There's a little bit of paternalism there. What about coming alongside, quote unquote, the little guy and recognizing whatever assets the little guy has, and then using our power in ways that build up his power or her power. So this notion of sharing our power, I think is a really helpful, concept. And actually, you know, Andy Crouch has written about that so well in his books. So if you really want to know about the stewardship of power, read Andy's book called Playing God, because it's terrific.
Noted. Andy is another one of those people. He's been
awesome
on the podcast. And it's just, yeah, when I read Andy, I have to read and reread Andy. And when I hear him on a podcast or even on this, I feel like I have to replay Andy. But yes. Yeah, that idea of sharing power. Thank you for that. Amy, where would you want to round us out today with this discussion? Where would you land us? Someone who this has sparked something in them. They start to think, oh yeah, this is resonating with me. What would you want to leave them with today?
Well, I think that seeking the flourishing of others isn't easy. There are inspiring stories in the book, and I hope people will get inspired. The truth of the matter is, once you actually get out there and start sacrificing yourself and seeking the good of others and doing that in a way that actually costs you something, it can make you start feeling like you're not really flourishing that much. you just sort of feel like, oh, I'm just sort of sacrificing a lot. That's just reality. And so I think it's just really helpful to remember the promise that is embedded in the Christian call. And we hear it from Jesus when he talks about, you know, it's in the laying down of your life that you actually find your life. And it's even embedded in Jeremiah 29:7, because the promise, that the instruction is seek the peace and, you know, pray for the city and seek its shalom. But then there's a promise, because in its shalom, you will find your own shalom. So as you are faithful to me, your God, in seeking the flourishing, even of your enemies, because let's face it, I mean, that's a command given to the exiles in Babylon, to the people that had captured them and brought them out of their homeland and brought them, you know, into this foreign land. So the letter to the exiles, I mean, had to have been a cause of such tremendous consternation. You know, this notion that God would be telling us to love these people that are pagan and terrible and the enemy of God and the enemy of Israel. And yet God is saying, no, I want you to actually seek their well-being. And the promise is that in their well-being, you will find your own. And so I think reminding ourselves of that promise, not that you do it for the promise, not that not that it's sort of this calculation of, oh, okay, well, like if I sacrifice for somebody else, then somehow God's going to like really bless me or something. It's not that, but it's resting. It's a resting in this idea of, okay, this is the narrow way that God is calling me. This isn't the broad, easy way. This is the narrow way. And it's going to be hard, but to remember that it really is the way ultimately of true flourishing, It is the way ultimately of true and deep and lasting joy. It is the way of true life, real life. Even though at times along that way, as we lay down ourselves for others, for their flourishing, it can be hard. But to remember, yeah, God's designed this in a certain way. And the shalom is coming for you too.
Amen. That's a good word, Amy. Again, the book is Agents of Flourishing, Pursuing Shalom in Every Corner of Society. And I will put the link where you can get your hands on that book in the show notes, as well as the organizations and the authors and the other books that Amy and I mentioned today, so that we can all have the resources that we need, or at least some starting places to get going in pursuing the flourishing of our neighbors. Thanks for being here, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.